I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the London Review Bookshop, where I am absolutely delighted to welcome Laura Pawson to talk about Spent Light, her extraordinary new book out with CB. Thank you so much for being here, and thank you to Charles as well. Thank you also to Jennifer Hodgson, who's going to talk to Laura about the book tonight. I cannot wait to hear what you've got to say. I enjoyed it, really, really enjoyed it, and I'm really looking forward to this conversation, as I'm sure you all are too. Our guests will talk for about 40, 45 minutes. There'll be time for questions afterwards. I'll have this mic. It's bound to be popular. We'll get through as many of those questions as possible. Give me a little wave or a wink and we'll do as many of those as we can. Then we'll go less formal. Laura will sign. We can have some wine and celebrate together. That's enough from me. Please help me say a great big thank you and welcome to our guests.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Us.
Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Lara, shall we start with a reading?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Okay. Straight off the bat.
Let's just get straight in there.
Yeah, let's.
I was going to do a longer bit in the middle, but we thought it would take too long. So I'm just going for a short bit at the beginning. I hope that's okay. Sorry if you've already read the first few pages. When I think back to how we first met, Reg is standing, smiling in a woolen coat in winter, and I'm in shorts, my bare legs, enjoying the heat of the sun. When I zoom in on the memory of that moment, Reg fills the screen, his stainless steel spectacles, his combed over hair, and his brown derby shoes laced up tight. I slip out of shot. I couldn't say the two of us ever managed to close the gap and become friends, but warmth was there from the start. More often than not, when I was popping to the shops or on my way back home, Reg would call out from his front door and we'd engage in light conversation. Our relationship grew like this for several years, layer upon layer of chat about holidays, the weather, our neighbours, local politics, vegetables, World War II and cars. I learnt that he'd always voted Conservative and that he still went ballroom dancing alone every Wednesday night. He rarely spoke about his wife, whose name I recall as Jean. The name Jean may be on my mind because an academic whose work I like is called Jean, and her partner, also an academic, whose work I also like, or used to like more than I do now, has been mentioned a lot on social media because he's been accused of sexually harassing his students. Whatever her name was, I never actually saw Reg's wife, not even a hand behind the nets, behind their clean closed windows. There were days when I doubted she existed at all, days when he said he'd taken her to the doctor and he'd gesture at the car, but the car was always empty and cold. It was during one of these exchanges that I learnt they'd never married, but had lived together since the 1950s in the same terraced house halfway up the street. When the stair lift appeared in the front garden, I knew she was dead. Reg came rushing out of the house and pushed a toaster into my hands. "I've a better one in Chingford anyway," he said. I remember looking up to the sky. The starched light of the sun was pushing through the clouds. I was straining to keep my eyes open, trying to see what was inside the blinding white haze. I thanked him and strode home, the plug bouncing off my leg, your semen still leaking into the gusset of my pants. I had never owned a toaster before. It has good dimensions, like those leather handbags that used to be held at the elbow by women of a certain leaning, women who lent their husbands their garters and attended funerals in pillbox hats. At one end, three buttons the shape of pellets of rat shit. Above each button, a shell of red plastic encases a tiny bulb. If I rub one of these for a moment or two, the dog's nipple comes to mind, or the trigger pin on an Armalite semi-automatic, or that inarticulate surge of pleasure when your finger closes in on my clitoris. Above each light, fractionally off-centre, a word is printed in the same restrained font found in CIA documents. Together, they form a synopsis of the Anthropocene. Reheat, defrost, cancel. To the right of these buttons is a dial the size of an adult anal sphincter. It has a dorsal fin that is the most elegant aspect of the entire machine, sparking visions of a porpoise curling in and out of breaking waves. It's the most sinister too. Not because the porpoise died with 23 plastic bags in its stomach and the string from a tampon of a girl who panicked and ran to the sea to secrete this foreign object the only way she knew how, but because the dial controls heat. Heat, like a sharp rise on the price of bread, can trigger strife. Indeed, in Egypt, bread is known as aish, which is Arabic for life. The whole thing is encased in steel, stained on one side with the paw prints of a startled cat. It has a skirt too, a thick black skirt that hides the machine's feet and the intricate connections that convert electricity into heat. A skirt that turns my thoughts to that old woman who sat across the aisle from us on the bus to Orgiva. As the long vehicle swept in and out along the twisting road of the Alpujarra, she began to sweat, her hands to fuss, and bile and bits of breakfast congregated between her lips. Then her eyes became wet. She said she couldn't breathe through her nose, and she held that long white envelope like a cradle to her mouth. It was only after the final turn into the town that the tension eased. She spread her feet, and from beneath her long black skirt, panting in the heat, the tongue of a solid old dog. She said she was six when a bullfighter called Pepe pointed a gun at her mother and gave the order to drink from a bottle of castor oil. Aggressive vomiting was followed by rapid labour, the little girl watching as the knot of wet flesh flopped onto the parched street of the beautiful hilltop town. She said she still remembered the smell of her mother's diarrhoea and the silence that came down like heavy velvet when the brick sunk into her brother's soft skull. Because I think of that woman whenever I use the toaster, and because I think of her mother being forced to drink castor oil, sometimes I imagine myself being forced to drink it too. Sometimes I even imagine myself forcing someone else to drink it. What would have had to happen to me to make me be so cruel? Thanks.
The prize people started laughing.
Didn't expect it to provoke laughs. Thank you.
This toaster.
It's toaster.
This toaster. I'm going to start with the toaster because I feel like I've got a small stake in this part of the story.
You have.
And I love to feel important. I remember in spring 2018, when we hadn't known each other very long, I received an email from Lara saying, would you like to come to this exhibition at the V&A with me? There's a toaster that I really need to look at. And
that's
I was
right.
Like, absolutely, let's go.
Yeah, some of you might have been to the show that was on at the V&A about objects and technology and, as I remember it, and I might be completely misremembering it, the kind of the danger of of technology. And there was a poster on the Underground about... it said something like, your toaster could kill you. And I kept thinking, yeah, it probably could kill you.
Yeah.
And I've been thinking, I suppose I should also give some context, which is that I'd been at a book event like this at Houseman's, the wonderful Houseman's bookshop in King's Cross. And Joanna Walsh, a writer that we know and probably some of you do, she was sitting here, and she was talking about the way that women get criticised because... we use our own lives to write fiction. And she quoted Sheila Hetty, another writer, who had said, and I haven't got the exact quote, I thought I should have printed it out so I could have read it to you, so please don't, I hope I'm not misquoting her, but apparently Sheila Hetty said, you know, of course we use our lives and ourselves to write. You can't do it by looking at a toaster. And I sort of sat there thinking, well, you could. You could do it.
Watch me.
You could do it, yeah. And I sort of became obsessed with that. And that was then when we went to look at
the toaster.
Yeah, and actually, as I remember, that exhibition was a little bit disappointing because I think I was going there hoping for kind of answers and proof when, of course, that isn't what you need. You just need to sit with the thing and see what happens in your mind. You don't need to go and get backup from the V&A.
No.
You know. But I think that was what I was looking for. I think I wanted sort of proof that I was right.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like that's the toaster.
Yeah. And then you could go away in your own time and just sit and contemplate the toaster, the radiator, the fridge magnets, because there are all those images in the book of the protagonist doing just that, sitting and just looking, really looking and looking again at perfectly ordinary domestic appliances. And I wonder if those images describe how it was to write it, whether you did sit there contemplating the fridge door.
Some of the time I did. I mean, I did keep the toaster on my desk for quite a long time. And I remember talking to Charles Boyle, my amazing publisher who's here, who said to me, well, of course, you didn't, like, look at them like that. You would have just encountered them and thought about them. And I then sort of thought, oh, well, yeah, no, I didn't actually quite do that. I mean, I did that with some of the things, but some of the things... I didn't have, but some of the things I brought to my desk and I would just stare at them. In fact, I mean, I got so sick of the fucking toaster that in the end I gave it away. Once I'd finished with it, I just thought, I can't look at this toaster. And also, you know, we've got a grill, so we don't really need a toaster. So the toaster's gone.
Served
but, yeah, I did keep things on my desk and I did look at things and... you know, I did really study them and I kind of made myself stare at them until I hated them.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like... But, I mean, the other thing I suppose I'm thinking is that despite the sort of dates when this book was written, you know, it wasn't... The idea didn't come to me during lockdown, because when lockdown happened, I thought, oh, God, everybody's going to think, well, she's sitting at home and all she can do is write about her home. And I thought, no, I had this desire to write about the domestic space because... do you mind me running on with this?
Go for it. That's what we're here for.
Because, you know, this writer's here and the writers here, I'm sure, will be familiar with this. But the first book I wrote was about Angola, a country that I lived in as a journalist. And after I'd written that, my agent at the time said to me, right, you know, what's the next country you're going to write about in Africa and what's the next massacre you're going to do?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, but I live in North London. Mm-hmm. Why would I do that? And then the next book I wrote was prompted by Tim Etchells, who's also here tonight. And that ended up being a memoir. And after that, someone said to me, oh, well, you know, you could publishing world people said to me, well, you know, you could write a bit more about your life. Why don't you write about a different bit of your life? And I just thought, you know, what is it with publishers and the publishing industry that they want you to keep reproducing what you've just done? And I kept thinking to myself, you know, I want to write something that is as unlike what I've done before. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I don't want it to be, it's so sort of dishonest to sort of associate me with Africa, you know, mm-hmm. This is recorded, you know, in inverted commas.
Yeah.
And I just thought, what can I do? What is my life really like? And I thought, well, I spend a lot of time in this house with these things, and that's what I want to write about. And my only rule was it can't be things outside of the brick walls of my home. Mm-hmm. And I started kind of sort of honing it down as much as I could. And I thought, this will be the real test. Can I write about really boring things, mm-hmm. apparently boring things, which of course objects are never boring, but can I do that and just see where my imagination takes me and what kind of fiction I can produce, what kind of words I can produce.
Mm-hmm. And there's the final couple of lines from the passage that you read, which is from the very beginning of the book, they sort of seem to contain something of what it's doing when you say, whenever I use the toaster, I think of her mother being forced to drink castor oil. Sometimes I imagine myself being forced to drink it too. Sometimes I even imagine myself forcing someone else to drink it. Because, like, with a book like this, we might expect a more conventional kind of book to kind of like be inviting us to do the work of the kind of empathic imagination, to try and like throw our imaginations into the suffering of another person. But your book is doing something way stranger than that, right?
Is it?
Yeah. I'm here telling you that, so it must be true in front of all these people. It seems, yeah, this book seems to be doing is something much stranger, because what you're saying is like, is I could, is it's closer than you think. It's not separate, it's closer than you think. And also the sense of like identification with both victim and perpetrator, and this openness to the kind of illicit pleasure or erotics of suffering, brutality, violence.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Jen, you're so kind of good at articulating things in a way that I can't. So I really appreciate you doing that for me.
You're welcome.
But I feel that, you know, it's such a funny thing, writing, because, you know, when I first started writing, I was a journalist, so I tried to write accurately about what I observed and what I heard and what I witnessed. But as I've now on, you know, book three, what I really try to do is to try and capture what is in my mind, what is in my head, and get it on the page, which sounds kind of quite straightforward, but I find it incredibly hard. So I wasn't, when I did this, I wasn't setting out to write about, to have lots of violence in a book. That was not my intention. I was just struck by that you can't do it by looking at a toaster. And I thought, well, what would happen if I did that? And I was actually really appalled by the fact that I kept on that kind of violence and fascism and I suppose very sort of dark material, sexual violence kept coming up, but mm-hmm. that's what's in my head. And I mean, I was told when I first finished this book and it was sent, I'm not going to name people, but I was told that, you know, the violence was potentially gratuitous. And that made me so angry. It still makes me so angry. I was like, you know, we only have to pick up our telephones and scroll through social media, but or just turn on the radio or just pay attention to your neighbourhood. There is so much violence happening all around us all the time. You know, we have children, that poor child who died because he was inhaling black mould in his shitty landlord's appalling property. So I think I just started to feel, well, this is the stuff inside me. And of course it is, because the world is very, very violent and brutal. Mm-hmm. And if there are people in the publishing world who think I'm being gratuitous, then they're just not alive to the world. Mm. And that is their problem, not mine. Mm. I mean, you know, so I am a bit sort of, you know, I feel like I am obsessed with, I am quite obsessed. It is a kind of obsession of mine, violence, but it's there all the time. So I find it odd that there's not more violent texts, mm-hmm. and more violent, not more work that's capturing how bloody the world is. And I don't just mean in terms of kind of like the appalling genocidal onslaught in Gaza. I don't just mean things like that. I mean the, you know, the, and not even, I don't just mean the sort of people you see in tents at the traffic lights. There's just, we live in a very brutal system that is very cruel and brutal to many, many people. Mm-hmm. God, sorry, I'm really sort of, I went, that was a bit of a rant, wasn't it? Sorry.
You're allowed.
I'm sorry.
You're
I'm
definitely
sorry.
Allowed.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely allowed. And I, you know, I think the idea, to me as a reader, the idea of the book being gratuitously violent, like, is to miss its central point entirely.
Because yeah.
The point of the book is that violence is ordinary, it's embedded and yeah. permeated. Yeah.
And there is gratuitous violence, but it's not in my book. It's there.
It's factual.
It's just there.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm trying very hard not to swear. Yeah.
I think we're allowed to swear.
No, I don't think. I was here last week and I heard a really.
Gail says we're allowed to swear.
Well, but I just.
I'm going to swear
cool.
in a minute.
No, it's not cool. I don't want to swear. I swear too much. Please don't encourage me.
Okay.
I don't want to swear on.
All
I
right.
I don't want to swear on the record.
All right. Oh, yes, yeah, a podcast. In amongst this kind of like compulsive seeing, this like obscene seeing of like the violence underpinning everything, there's also I'm really struck by the sensuousness and the beauty of the things, like the kind of relationship that the narrator has with things. I'm thinking especially of this way that you describe an ashtray, like a curl of golden syrup. And throughout the book, the entire book, it's this like incredibly like intense haptic relationship with things. There's a kind of like love-hate relationship with objects. Like, on the one hand, you talk about having given everything away at a certain point and the things that
yeah.
you got too attached to,
yeah.
you burned. And then, on the other hand, there's this sense of, interest in beauty and form and hapticity and also often the ways that things can, like, extend your capacities as a person or kind of, like, mess up your sense of identity. I'm thinking of like the kind of accomplishment that with the tick remover.
The tick remover.
Or with the kind of dog taser collar. The sense of.
I'm really hoping you wouldn't bring that up.
Why?
Because I'm sure that people will be offended.
You've got to put your money where your mouth is, Lara.
Well, I'd definitely do that.
Known for it. You're known for it. But. This kind of strange love.
It's not a taser collar, by the way. It is not a taser collar.
Do you want to give it its appropriate name?
I'm not sure what its appropriate name is, but it's not taser.
Right.
It's like a electronic.
Electric, right. That's
we'll
really different,
discuss that
isn't
it? Later in the bar.
It's really different.
It truckles.
Have you brought it?
No, of course I haven't brought it. Oh, my God. Yeah.
Mm. Should we leave the... OK.
Yeah, go on.
No. I'm really interested in this love and hate relationship with stuff, with things.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I would want it to be so kind of binary of love and hate, but I think In fact, another thing, I did bring this with me because I wanted to show you, because actually Jen told me about this book, and this book really, it's called The Tears of Things by the amazing Peter Schwenger. And you told me about this book. It's a really amazing book. I'd really recommend it to anyone. But I that book gave me the confidence to keep going, because I found myself, the more I thought about objects and the more I thought about the things around me, the more I associated myself and my body with these things. And the more that I started to kind of, you know... I mean, it's funny because I'm sort of saying I, but I feel that the I in the book is definitely not me. I mean, it's a weird sort of... And the object, the sort of the, because I sort of, yeah, I found myself the eye becoming more and more of another object.
Ah.
And the objects having more and more of a sort of equal relationship,
yeah,
with the human beings in the book.
Yeah.
And actually I feel that, you know, I think that that is... Those are, that is the relationship we have with things. That, mm-hmm, was the thing I was really trying to sort of dig into. And now I kind of think, why was I even ever querying that? Of course, that's how we live,
mm-hmm,
here, certainly. I feel like, and there is, you're right, there is a bit in the book where I talk about trying to get rid of objects and the narrator getting rid of objects and burning them. And I'm sure that we've all done that. You know, there are things, or you just, you know, that you give away to a charity shop, or you just take in a black bag because you just, for whatever reason, you can't be with them anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I feel like it's so hard to talk about this slightly weird book and this weird relationship with objects, because I'm not even sure that I'm, even though I kind of, obviously I finished the book and it's published and here we are, you know, and it's sitting there, but I'm still not sure that I fully understand what's going on there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally.
And I still feel kind of puzzled and uneasy about the objects, my sort of my encounter with objects and how we live with them and how we live with people and how we live with ourselves and our own bodies kind of being objects.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. At times it almost feels like you're kind of saying objects are nicer than they should be. You know, there's that bit where... I think you're talking about a boiler. I think it's a boiler. And you say, like, why do these rubberized buttons feel so amazing when they should be covered in, like, bogies and shit to reflect the circumstances of their, you know, production and the extractive, yeah, industrial...
A thermostat.
A thermostat,
they're
sorry.
Heating fossil fuels.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, again, it's just a sort of desire to try to be honest about how to try to kind of get to the heart of what I'm feeling and thinking when I'm, you know, holding a glass or, mm-hmm, or, you know, rubbing this material or, you know, running my fingers over this table. It's like, what is actually happening there? And I think, you know, to go back to what we were talking about earlier, or what I was sort of talking about earlier, of having been a sort of foreign correspondent and lived abroad, and the way that people here, particularly if you sort of say, oh, I work for the BBC, it's very sort of exotic and people think it's very exotic and fancy. But actually there's something, I realise there's a real kind of exotic quality to a lot of the plain things that we have around us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I just feel like it's that sort of opened up a whole new way of understanding the world, actually,
mm-hmm,
for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned about the relationship between bodies and objects and you know, the body is like one object amongst many. And I wondered if we could talk about... Go on.
Well, I was going to say...
Go on.
I was going to say that another thing that came up with a person in the publishing industry was that the word or the mention of clitoris came too early in the book and that would put people
not within the first 50 pages, is it?
Something like that. You know, could I not put that later on in the book? And I just found myself thinking, well, in fact, I was just having a conversation with Charles earlier about, well, yeah, maybe that's too convoluted to go into now, but, you know, we're all thinking about cocks and cunts all the time, aren't we? I mean, isn't that what everybody's doing? And, you know, you see people talking to them and they've got their hand down their top and, you know, I think that, you know, bits of my body I do feel are kind of not attached to me. I'm like, where did that come from? And I found myself, you know, I find myself, you know, just in my, I don't know about the rest of you, but when I go around in the world and I'm sort of out there, I'm constantly thinking about, I'd done a toenails. Like, that was another thing, was toenails.
I was going to ask you about dandruff, but you've completely preempted me.
Dandruff. Oh, it's dandruff.
Well, the kind of, if we're being, like, very accurate, the kind of collectings on the little spikes of the hairbrush, the nests.
Yeah.
Because there's something that you say, I'm going to quote you now. There's something that you say where there's a kind of extended passage about a hairbrush. Lara writes about getting this hairbrush from Boots and the brushing of the hair, which is a person with a manageable hair I was really relating to. But the bit that you say about the way that the hair and the flaky skin collects on the hairbrush, you say, were it not for the tiny nests at the base of every bristle, I might have spiraled into bitter loathing long ago.
Yeah.
And that, like, really caught in me, and I couldn't quite work out what you meant by it, but I really liked it. Like, that sense of, like, the consolation of these, like, bodily residues.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure if it's the bodily residue that counts there for me. But,
what
you know, it's for you, it's a, you know, that's the thing, isn't it? You throw it out there and everyone has their own response.
But why is it for you?
Well, I just think, I can't say what it is for me now because I'd have to really think about that. But when I was writing that, I thought those little bits that get caught around the bottom of the, what are they called, like the spokes of a hairbrush, the little bits that stick out, the little...
Bristles.
The bristles, yeah, but they weren't quite bristles because they're sort of rubbery nose, sort of like long...
We're really getting into it now,
but the things at the bottom, they are quite beautiful, they are quite special.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing, if you really look at stuff, it takes on a value and a weight that I think gets overlooked, and that's a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's... I mean, that's the other thing. I could have just kept on writing forever and ever and ever because there's so many things that are so... that, you know, I feel a real desire to write about. But I felt like enough was enough. It could get self-indulgent, and I'm not into that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I probably am self-indulgent. In a way, it's a very self-indulgent book. But I just think, no, you just want a shot and then stop.
Mm-hmm. The book is addressed to a you.
Yes.
Throughout, on and off. I was wondering how important it was when you were writing for it to be addressed to someone else. Well, it was always addressed to someone else.
I can't remember exactly the process. I mean, I can say that, you know, writing this book was a real nightmare. I found it really, really, really hard.
Mm-hmm.
Really hard. To the point of I just thought, you know, what the fuck am I doing? This is a ridiculous project. It's taking me forever. But I think I think there was a part of me that wanted to see if I could get away with that, if I could pull it off, if I could try to write to a you. And I think it might, I think it's that, you know, I feel like somewhere in my memory, I've heard people saying that, you know, writing to a you is really difficult and people don't like it and you shouldn't really do that. And I think at some point someone might have suggested to me that I put the whole book into the third person. And I just felt that was a bit of a cop out. Mm. I thought, no, I really want to test myself and I want to... I felt there was this kind of you that I was pushing into. And I thought, well, then just fucking put it, do it. Mm-hmm. Try it and see mm-hmm. what happens. But I did waver a lot with that, and I was sort of anxious, and I still am anxious about whether I really pulled it off. I'm not sure. I'm really not sure, but I just, I don't know. I mean, it's funny because you hear writers talking about their work, and there are people like here tonight who are fucking amazing writers and who are really good at talking about their work. And I feel like whenever I talk about my work, it's like I kind of almost, it's just better just to read it because I'm not very good at talking about it. Because I feel like when I write, I'm just trying so hard to try and put into words what I'm feeling in my head and my heart. Mm-hmm. And I'm never quite sure why I'm putting stuff down that I'm putting down. It's just that that's what's going down and you have to trust it.
Yeah.
I suppose that's the thing. You have to trust it.
Yeah.
You have to trust the sort of experiment, because it's all an experiment. I mean, it's not like it's experimental writing. Every writer is taking a leap, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know that. Mm-hmm. You know, that is the way it is, isn't it? And so the you was just a sort of... I just felt I had to do it, and I was thinking, shit, I really hope this works.
Mm-hmm. The you makes me think of that... that really beautiful section towards the end where you're talking about your burner fern, the blue burner fern, and you go off into this kind of like lyrical listing of all the things that you want to tell.
I really like that bit of the book.
Yeah, I really like it.
I really like that
it's beautiful.
Yeah,
it's a nice
bit.
At exactly the right time as well, somehow. Oh, Rich. Do you want to read that bit?
I could do. What do you think?
We can read that bit. If you want to read that bit, read that bit, and then we'll have the
I'll read that bit.
Questions,
I'll read
why
that
not?
Bit.
Is that right with everyone?
Yeah.
Okay, let's go, yeah.
I wonder if it'll have the same sort of... Oh, look, there it is.
Did you just open it right on there?
Yeah.
See, meant to be. Go on.
Meant to be. It's funny reading it here, but okay, I'll give it a go.
Yeah?
Here we go.
Thanks.
Thanks, Rachel. So, yeah, well, I better start there. OK. Walking along that lane, I tried to... A mobile phone, the burner phone...
Blue burner phone, orange burner phone.
...has been dropped. The narrator's dropped the burner phone, and this is what happens next. The burner phone breaks and it's all over the place. Walking along that lane, I tried to remember the name of the town in southern Congo, the one where toddlers cut cobalt from rock, where exposure to toxic heavy metals is leading to stillbirths and fetal abnormalities, where babies are born with legs that won't unfold and girls as young as one have been raped by men who believe that sex with a virgin will increase their chances of finding cobalt under the ground and decrease the chance of death. I tried to work out the difference between myself with my mobile phone and the millions of men who, in their desperate attempts to be sexually aroused, pay to download images of children being abused. The truth is, I've even noticed a feeling of excitement creeping up on me when I'm holding my mobile phone inside my pocket. It's the gratitude that comes from the knowledge that here I am, walking around with a tiny piece of Congo in my hand as if it could make up for all the Englishness I loathe. Here I am with my mobile phone calling you to tell you that I've just been eating wild blackberries the size of plums beside the Kingsmill factory, that I'm watching a young fox dozing in the grass on the edge of the forest, that the pale man with thin spectacles and three fat dogs has just tried to put his tongue inside my mouth on that path that runs beneath the railway bridge, that I've just seen another grass snake in the ditch beside London's last unploughed field, that a man in a purple turban is bowling cricket balls for his 9-year-old daughter and she's whacking them into space, that I was eavesdropping on a pair of Brazilian women who were laughing uncontrollably while sharing details of the large houses they clean near Mornington Crescent, that the dog just caught a young violet pigeon and I'd had to finish it off with my own hands in front of a male cyclist who seemed unfamiliar with death. That I never knew Babak's brother had become addicted to opium age 12. That I've met a man who has told me how to deflate the tyres of an SUV without using a knife, and will you do it with me? That I've reached a truce with the guy who keeps leaving half-drunk bottles of brandy on the curb beside our house. That I've apologised for the bucket of water I threw at his friend. That I want to travel to Guinea-Bissau before it's too late. That Nina Simone is changing the quality of my intellectual and emotional life. That she was a genius. That I can't believe I didn't understand this earlier in life. That visiting Edinburgh allowed me to experience the lightness of living in a land that won't vote Tory. That I think I want to become a backing singer, part of a trio, swaying and swinging and clicking our fingers in rhythm, in harmony, in tight blue jeans. That I've realised I am definitely, wholeheartedly, entirely anti-capitalist, and I'm thankful for that. That I've never been certain of what it means to be a woman. That I prefer wooden clogs to newborn babies. That before we're too old, I want you and I to take LSD in a skateboard park. That I have so much rage for the government, I'm beginning to wonder if it's actually a superpower. That I'm concerned my skill set is limited to topiary. That I've just been pinned down by evangelising Christians for the second time in a month. That I'm not sure for how much longer I can continue to avoid flying because I'm missing certain people so much my heart aches. That I'm sorry I got cross about the ladder to the attic, and yes, you're right, it doesn't matter anyway. That this is just a message to remind you to rub some of that Elizabeth Arden 8-hour cream my mother gave us for the dog's paws into your elbow. That I've been wondering where all the spiders are this year, the ones that spin those enormous webs between the washing line and the ceanothus. That I just heard a crow saying, "Oh my God, oh my God," as it flew overhead. That I wish you were with me to hear the man playing his saxophone beneath the grey poplars, serenading the streams of parakeets returning to roost in the branches above the lea. That I don't know what to do to try to save life on this planet. That I know you've all... That I know you've only been gone since breakfast, but I'm already missing you. That you forgot your lunch. That I really like all the binmen who work our street. That I think my diarrhoea is finally clearing up. That the dog just twisted his ankle chasing a crow on the football field, so we will be slow in getting home. That I forgot to mention the butcher. Could you ask him if he sells tripe? That the amplifier is quietly screaming and I can't stop it. That I'm beginning to wish I believed in a god, and could we discuss this tonight? That I've eaten all the chocolate again and I wish you wouldn't buy it. That I regret not coming to Julius Eastman before now and I'm grateful to Otto for showing me the way. That I wish I could own an Auerbach oil, even a very small one that I could gaze into whenever I wished. That yes, you're right, I do live life with my emotional choke pulled out. That the little boy who I sprayed with water while he ran around the garden without any clothes on has just asked me if your purple toenail is still purple. That the menopause has got me thinking that perhaps women really are the weaker sex, and I don't think I can bear much more of this. That I've just seen a man with a face that might have been sculpted from wax sprinting into Chico's cafe shouting, "He's going to stab me! Hide me!" That I've just had a curious conversation with a pale man who told me that his tidy dog in a close-fitting harness has 2 or 3 panic attacks a day because it suffers from some form of PTSD not brought on by anything in particular, whereas his brother, who was 17 when he was sent to Angola, has suffered from PTSD for 38 years. That I'd like to buy this eyelash curler, but I wish it didn't remind me quite so much of the stainless steel speculum that was wedged into my vagina by a nervous medical student at my first smear test. That I keep thinking about what that man said, that people burn very well. That the dog's just caught a squirrel and it's quite a large one, so you don't need to worry about supper. That I'm about to get on the bus, that no one's wearing a mask, that I might walk, that I offered to share the squirrel with the neighbours via the street WhatsApp group and someone's now left the group. That there's an armed raid going down at number 55 and the brothers are in their boxers being cuffed and I've just asked the older one if he's OK and he said he's fine, thanks. That, of course, I will meet you at the tube, that I love you, that I'm missing you, that I can't wait to come home.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact,
you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Thanks, Lara.
Thank you. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Rich. Time for some questions. Raise the hands and the roving mic will be on its way. Got one over here.
Coming.
This is my sister. Spoiler. Hello.
Hi, Lara. I just wanted to say, I'll try not to cry. It's all right, isn't it? That's my favourite part that you just read. I thought it was really wonderful. But the thing you're talking about not the question mark over having a you, I don't understand. You can't not have a you. It's a love letter. And I don't understand that question mark as to why you wouldn't have done that. What's the question?
So there.
Yeah.
I'll say, always get a sibling asking a question at Q&A. Yeah. I agree with you, by the way. I absolutely agree. I want to hear that.
I'm not sure I've got an answer. I feel like, you know, your question says it all, isn't it? Yeah. And you don't always know till you finish something. I mean, you both said it's a love letter, and I thought, is it? Is it? I don't know. So thank you anyway. That's nice.
Hello, Lara.
This isn't my brother. I haven't just got family here.
Double focus going on here. Just going back to the thing about the toaster and sitting and staring at it and then sort of taking it apart takes me back to the toaster project by the guy.
Oh, yeah, so God, I read that book. That was... Flatka, who's here tonight, told me to read that book.
I think I probably got it by Tim.
Oh, my God, what an amazing book.
So read that book, everybody.
Just
looking at a toaster and sort of taking it to the extreme.
Yeah.
But taking something like, taking it to pieces but without any meaning is, you know, takes you back to the naming of parts by Siegfried Sassoon, who talks about the barrel and the bolt and the bar and the stock. Which is a wonderful thing. So you completely disassociate yourself from what the thing actually is.
Yeah.
But you take it to the extreme. So the bit about the toaster and staring at things and taking them back to absolute basics is fantastic and fundamental. And everybody should stare at everything every day and take it back to what 100%. The fuck has come from.
I'm with you all the way. Thanks, Mark.
No problem.
Yeah.
I think that, that last part you read was really moving, and I think we should all give another round of applause for that. It was fantastic. Oh. It was beautiful. It was really beautiful. I think it's your night. Let's indulge you. If you could write about one more thing only, what would you write about and why?
Oh, I do, you know, that's a really good question because I feel like I... because I just spend a lot of my time thinking, shit, why didn't I write about that? Why didn't I... Oh, God. Only one thing. I mean, I could come up with something, but I feel I'd be slightly lying just for the purposes of answering your question. I don't know if I could... Just don't know. Maybe, yeah, I'll think, then I'll let you know. Because it just, like... Mark has said, it's just, everything. Just there's so much there. Oh, I'm sorry to be disappointing.
Sorry, it's gone.
And we've got time for maybe one or two more.
Oh, here's something. Oh. Oh.
Laura, I haven't read the book yet because I haven't got a copy, but I will read it. Why is it called Spent Light?
Oh, I knew somebody was going to ask that.
I was going to ask that one.
And I was thinking about, I thought someone's going to ask me, why was it called Spent Light? Shall I tell them or shall I say you've got to read the book? Because I feel like if I tell you, it will spoil the book. It's not, it's lifted from something someone else said. And I just really like the fact that it's quite hard to know what it means. It's a bit odd. I'm still not sure I really know what it means. And I really like the fact that each word is just one syllable, that they're these sort of solid words of one syllable each. And I've become a bit obsessed. I mean, I'm not sure I should admit this, of course I will. I have become quite obsessed with... I'm not a fan of Gordon Lish's writing, but I am a big fan of his notes on how to write, and which I got actually in a way that I shouldn't have got. I have them on a PDF, which apparently you're not supposed to do because he's really weird about that. But anyway, someone gave me the PDF, so I have got them and I've shared them with other people, which will also make him angry. But I really like his work. And one of the things he talks about is the importance of words with one syllable. And I really agree with him. And I feel like good titles have one. I just think one syllable, that's all, you know, Spent Light. It's like, I don't know, it just... But the real sort of depth of it is inside the book.
Mm. But the nice thing about Spent is it's got pen in the middle.
Yes. I was going to say, and then ST on either end, but that's like sanitary towel for any woman sitting here. But yeah, pen in the middle is good.
Okay, one more question. We've got time for one more question.
We can't end it on a sanitary towel.
Yeah, bring us back on the rails. One more question. There we go.
There you go, you see.
Thank you. Hi, Laura. This is kind of the opposite to the question before last. Were there any objects that you found during the course of writing the book that struck you as wholly uninteresting or that didn't make the cut?
I think, yeah, that is a good question. I think, do you know what? I now can't remember. I can't, because I find it so hard to remember what I'm doing when I'm writing, other than panicking most of the time. But there definitely were bits I dumped. I just thought, and there were objects that I thought would be really interesting, and then they just weren't, and I had to ditch them. I hope that doesn't now undermine quite a lot of what I've been saying tonight.
Just makes me sound like a scientist.
Makes me sound like a bit of a fake, but that is the truth. Oh, God. Can we not have one more question? Can we have one more question?
One more quick, very quick one.
Sorry. Oh. I'm just joking. As someone who spends their life looking at objects and thinking what they are, and why are we keeping them, what you just said actually confirms it, because I have this sort of slight suspicion. It's not really... I don't mean to sound insane, but I have a slight suspicion that objects have an agency of their own.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Totally, mm-hmm. Totally.
Despite ourselves. And so some objects are
unsympathetic. Yeah. That's the awful thing. Yeah. No, that's it. That's the awful thing. Yeah. They kind of, and they're not even interested in you.
No, they don't. Yeah.
Yeah, no. Thank you.
Yeah. Going to have to draw to a close there. But
before we do.
Me first.
Okay.
But before we do. Yesterday was not only the publication day of Spent Light, but it was also Laura's birthday. And I would like you all to sing with me to her happy birthday. And the Butlin's red coat, sorry. So, to Charles as well. But to you, since you're sat on the stage. Yeah?
Go on.
If you'll all join with me.
Just take the lead, please.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Laura. Oh, happy birthday to you.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.